it's not a worse version of Bitcoin. It's just a better version of fiat. The reasons people typically use stablecoins are that there are certain use cases of fiat that are horrific. I think it is inevitable that stablecoins ultimately will settle over Bitcoin, probably over Lightning specifically. You know, the step in that direction just makes perfect economic sense.
The average Bitcoin critic will complain about how hard it is to make a Bitcoin transaction without having any idea how complicated or convoluted the average transaction that happens in the fiat banking system actually is. This week, we are joined by partner from Axiom Capital, Alan Farrington, for a conversation about the fiat banking system, the complication of ordinary payments, and how Bitcoin addresses these problems for the future. Hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are joined by special guest, author and investor and much more, Alan Farrington. Alan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks so much, Scott.
Hey, I wonder if for our listeners, if you could just give us a quick, very quick overview of who you are and how you got into the space.
Sure. Oh, I mean, how I got into the space might not be quick, but who I am, I can do quickly. So I am a co-founder and general partner at Axiom, which is a venture firm that focuses on Bitcoin companies, companies building on Bitcoin, however you want to try to capture that. Also, one of the co-founders and CEO of Flux, which is kind of like a sister company in a sense, also asset management business, but where we are deploying in Bitcoin. And that's a relatively new thing that we haven't been talking about for all that long, but I'm obviously excited about how I got into the space. There's honestly no sure answer there. It took a very long time and there was a lot of different influences. I'm here now.
Good enough. We were talking about this offline. I thought as an interesting maybe starting point for the conversation today, you recently gave a presentation about misconceptions people have around the current fiat payment system compared to Bitcoin and the Bitcoin Lightning Network.
Yeah, that was fun. I like that. It was the first time I'd done an actual planned presentation at a conference in a while. And it was at BTC++. So first of all, BTC++ is awesome. Absolutely amazing conference series. Highly, highly technical. And hence, one might wonder why I was allowed in. But it's always on a different theme every time. And so this most recent one, the theme was Lightning. And so I saved this planned talk for a while to try to sneak in on the basis that, you know, I think it's pretty much the very first thing I say in the talk that I mean, I know a decent amount about how Bitcoin works and how Lightning works, but, you know, relative to the audience at BTC++, probably didn't know a whole lot. But I was nearly certain I knew more than them about how fiat works. And so the whole shtick that I wanted to, I think I made this joke too, it's you know, something like a public service that I'm delivering is debunking the idea that fiat payments are easy and simple and Bitcoin payments are like a headache in comparison. Bitcoin payments are kind of a headache, hence literally everything else that was discussed at this Lightning-centric conference, but fiat's even worse.
Yeah, I was basically you went about diagramming this ridiculously complex matrix of interbank transfers.
I had a lot of fun with that.
So maybe, I guess you didn't go on to talk about it in this way, but how are you thinking about Lightning as a viable solution for payments?
It's funny you mentioned I didn't talk about it. I cut a bunch of stuff because it was too long. I was only supposed to speak for 30 minutes. I think the actual talk's like 31 or 32 minutes or something. I'd kind of like to do a follow-up at some point where I basically just pick up where I left off and mention all the things I didn't have time for. But yeah, one of the obvious such things is, how does Lightning compare? That, you know, when I said I snuck into the conference, part of what I'm alluding to is I didn't really say anything about Lightning at all at this Lightning themed conference, other than, you know, by implication, surely Lightning is much better than this. In terms of how Lightning does actually compare, I'm going to have to get into the weeds a little bit. Like, there's a bit of, I guess, foundation of the argument I was making that you need, I think, to appreciate my answer. Because I don't think there's a straightforward answer, basically. I think, if anything, that in and of itself might be an interesting place to start, that I think it's more or less understood now that a lot of the early hype around Lightning was a bit misplaced. At the same time, I'm very cautious that I really strongly dislike Lightning FUD, other than to say what I just said, which is that a lot of the early hype was displaced. But if what you believe around Lightning which I don't think anyone really says anymore, but they did, you know, 2019 to 21 or so, that Lightning just solves payments, or Lightning scales Bitcoin, and we're kind of done at that point. That is obviously wrong. I think was obviously wrong even at the time. That deserves a skepticism, and I guess now some degree of, you know, scorn and mockery and whatnot. But equally, there's like another layer in my mind, or at least in my recollection of how this narrative played out, of kind of misrepresenting what that hype even was. I think that, you know, I'm sure that existed on Twitter at the time, but I think that most sensible people I ever interacted with about this always appreciated what Lightning's limitations were. And if anything, it's just that the more extreme hype has now caught up with the sensible expectations. And so that then gets to like, okay, where do I think Lightning actually fits in, and where and how does it compare to different parts of the fiat payment system? To me, Lightning is absolutely not, you know, fixing Bitcoin payments and just scaling Bitcoin perfectly, and we don't need anything else. I think it's an excellent analog to something like ACH, in that it is perfect for businesses to pay one another, and really nice difference to how ACH actually works, which obviously I go into this in a lot more detail in the talk. Let me go into it now too if you want. Major difference: ACH has to run through banks. It's a means for businesses to pay one another, but it has to run through commercial banks, which in turn means it has to run through central banks. To me, the best way to conceive of Lightning is that it naturally slots into that business-to-business role, but in an open way. So you don't need a commercial bank, and you obviously don't need a set. There's kind of no conception even of a central bank here. It's almost like Bitcoin itself is the central bank function. And then maybe, I'm not sure if this maps as cleanly as I would like, but maybe Lightning is kind of the commercial bank function, in that businesses can just plug directly into Lightning and transact peer-to-peer. But I would caution that I don't think it extends very well to the end consumer. And this is basically like, this is the now, I think, relatively well accepted critique of Lightning as a panacea, that it, while it's, you know, absolutely amazing in some ways, the problems of inbound liquidity and needing to be always online are probably not solvable for consumers. Like, just for regular people, these are not things that anybody is remotely used to. I guess it's an open question of like, can people just learn new habits around this? But I think the conservative position, like the null hypothesis, is no, they won't. Whereas for businesses, these are completely trivial things, right? Like every business, and really today, I don't think it even depends what kind of business you are, like what industry you're in. You have the infrastructure to have an always online, certainly, like everybody has this. And the inbound liquidity is just a question of working capital management, which again is totally alien to regular people, but is totally normal for businesses. So in conclusion, Lightning is on the one hand amazing, but on the other is not for absolutely everything, and it doesn't quite fix Bitcoin. It's a crucial layer of enabling different kinds of Bitcoin payments. I do still think you need some more around the edges.
This is maybe a little bit of like a turn for this, you know, I guess what it makes me think of is you've written a number of different pieces that address sort of the broader systemic and structural downstream problems of fiat, the money and fiat banking. So I wonder, yeah, maybe if we could talk a little bit sort of about the core thesis of Bitcoin is Venice, or, you know, how does what you're talking about here, the problem of payments in the fiat world, relate to some of your like bigger ideas around?
Hopefully the answer is a bit simpler than you're suggesting. I don't think we need a full like book review of Bitcoin is Venice to appreciate this necessarily. But the way I presented this content in the talk was, I don't know if I succeeded necessarily, but it was to try to make the point as sort of clearly and strongly as possible that the nuisance I'm describing, like how absurdly complicated it is entirely downstream of some pretty core properties of fiat. I think the most fundamental being that because fiat only exists as commercial bank liabilities, like it, I mean, other than cash, which is kind of beside the point for how almost all payments work these days, to quote unquote hold fiat, like to own fiat, means you have an asset that is the liability of a commercial bank. With that as the starting point, pretty much everything follows quite naturally in terms of how like Visa works, for example. There's a lot to build up, but like the consequences are pretty clear. by virtue of the fact that that makes debits impossible. So there, I say this a couple of times in the talk, I would be happy if this became kind of a slogan. There is no such thing as a fiat debit. It simply does not exist. There is only extensions of credit. And the reason that you end up with this complicated mess and the, you know, the image that I think you were referring to with all the arrows and the ledgers and everything is that there are so many, in just a, you know, totally normal Visa payment. I make up this kind of joke example where you're just buying a chair, right? In any remotely typical fiat payment, there are so many middlemen taking on very slightly different credit risks by enabling the extension of credit from you to the merchant, to the guy selling you the chair, that, you know, you might think naively, oh, but I can just, like, there's only two of us involved, or, you know, maybe there's like our two banks are involved and there's not much more than that. But there's actually way, way, way more than that. If only it were that simple. I forget what number I even came up with, because there's different ways it can work in the first place. But it was something like, you know, I came up with what I thought was not the simplest, like I did want it to be amusing. So it's not the simplest it could possibly be, but it was nowhere near as complicated as it could possibly be either. And there were like 9 different intermediaries and I think something like 14 payments going between them, all of which are extensions of credit that the intermediaries have to take a cut of. And so I guess one takeaway would be something like, this isn't a question of Visa being badly designed, for example, or like even central banking being badly designed. The point is more, if you have fiat money at all, if central banking exists, something like this is unavoidable. And that leads nicely to the Lightning comparison too, which again, I don't even really make explicitly in the talk because I kind of assume the audience is familiar with how Lightning works, you know, certainly relative to how this all works. But with Lightning, it's, and with, you know, and with Bitcoin and with any real layer two on Bitcoin, one, there are debits. Like debit is a real thing. You can't actually just pay somebody. And then everything that's downstream of that is, you know, simple in the way that everything downstream of fiat all being credit is complicated. So, you know, Lightning can seem complicated if you have a disproportionately or you know, unusually complex payment route or whatever, or if you're super hung up on inbound liquidity and always online is a nuisance. But really, when you compare this to the fiat, it's just so much mind-bogglingly worse.
Yeah, I guess here it's going to always be trade-offs, but I wonder about businesses' ability to onboard this idea, you know, because the other thing that you talk a lot about, which I think businesses do already understand very well, both the latency and the fees, like all of the different inefficiencies that have to like cobble together to make this thing work.
Yeah, this is a really good point, actually. I didn't draw that much attention to this. So this is a good idea for when I do part two. I'll maybe mention this as well, that all of this is hidden from consumers. So yes, you're exactly right that anybody who's run, in particular, a small business where you are sort of forced to see this, like you're forced to interact with it. You don't have, you know, a financing department because you're a Fortune 500 company or whatever. Like you actually have to deal with the consequences of this. You're well aware of chargeback risk and cash flow constraints and, you know, the nuisance even of getting signed up with a merchant acquirer, you know, via a payment processor and having the, making sure that if you're, you know, if it's in person, the point of sales terminals are synced up with all of this, like all of the crap you need to even accept the payment in the first place, never mind the headaches of like actually getting the money at the end of the day. Businesses are aware of this. It's very cleverly I don't think this is like a conspiracy or anything. I think it's sort of obvious why it would evolve this way, but consumers are like, they see nothing. As far as they're concerned, you actually get this a lot in, you know, more circa 2024, 25 Bitcoin FUD that the normies are now getting into, you know, as opposed to like mining's bad for the environment from 5 years ago or whatever, or tulip bubble, right? You don't hear that much anymore. What you hear now is typically like, oh, but Apple Pay just like works. Like you pay and you're done. And it's like, why do you need something better than that? It's like, well, ask the merchant if they think Apple Pay works. Like it works for you. It doesn't work for them.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's another one of those things where there is adoption, merchant adoption of Lightning happening. Like, it's not like it's everywhere, but if you go to El Salvador or Costa Rica, Vancouver, there's large, you know, numbers of businesses accepting it, and they can see that it's solved. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big hope of mine, actually, for, I guess, just the spread of Bitcoin in general. I don't quite want to say hyper Bitcoinization, but, you know, where the next wave of adoption is going to come from. I do have this kind of niggling fear, not to be too bearish about it, but I do wonder from time to time, you know, have we got all the low hanging fruit in terms of people who will get this intellectually, and like, where's the next wave going to come from? And I don't know if it's going to be the next wave necessarily, but something I am really hopeful around is precisely via this wedge of fiat payment inefficiency that merchants slowly start to get it, even if they don't really care about Bitcoin, right? Like, if they're not doing it as a way of getting Bitcoin necessarily, you could set up Bitcoin acceptance, and I'm sure a lot do actually, such that you're literally only using it as payment rail, right? You just immediately convert it into dollars, pounds, whatever, fiat. But because you're familiar with the inefficiencies of accepting, you know, Visa via Apple Pay and the 10 other intermediaries that are involved, you get the incentives, and like, that starts a bit of a positive feedback loop. I think the nicest way, and I'll credit the Zaprite guys in particular for this, as far as I'm aware, they were the first to articulate it this way and kind of popularize this articulation, that we'll know that this is well underway when you start seeing, at the very least, discounts for paying with Bitcoin. But the framing I really, really like is premium for paying in fiat, right? Because I think that's like really amusing psychologically, like the difference where it amounts to exactly the same thing, right? It's just like, where, you know, what arithmetic are you using to explain the difference in prices? But I really like forcing people to think it's like you're causing the merchant a problem by paying in fiat. Like, why are you doing this to me? I need to charge you more for this nuisance. Like, that, when that becomes, I've seen this here and there, but when that becomes more normalized, then we'll really know we're winning.
Yeah. What would be your take on what's happening right now with stablecoins and stablecoins' ability to solve that problem without, you know, like, without needing Bitcoin?
I don't know if you're aware of this, but I have a whole other, I haven't done a talk about this, but I have a whole other relatively long, like, essay. It's more like a blog post. It's not really an essay, but that I did. I don't write as much these days as I used to, but this is one of the more recent things I've written. I don't want to trace out the entire argument here because it's quite involved, but basically I'm kind of, on the one hand, I am pragmatic in accepting that stablecoins are real and they're not to be dismissed as crypto bullshit, unlike most crypto bullshit, which I think is the natural Bitcoiner instinct to just dismiss everything as crypto bullshit, but stablecoins are clearly real. But on the other hand, I think the most sensible interpretation of that is to resist linking it to Bitcoin or frankly even crypto at all. It's not a worse version of Bitcoin, it's just a better version of fiat. Like, that to me is a much cleaner way of interpreting what's even happening, and that the reasons people are using, as far as I can tell, like, I don't want, obviously, so this is somewhat anecdotal, but as far as I can tell, the reasons people typically use stablecoins are that there are certain use cases of fiat that are horrific, and this is just an improvement. It's by no means, you know, a perfect money. And actually, I literally just saw this today. I don't know exactly how contemporary it is, but there was, you know, it was like news that Tether had frozen, I want to say $26 million worth of, you know, somebody's Tether. So like, that's a good, and obviously I was seeing this because it was, it must've been on Twitter. But it would only have come to my attention because some Bitcoiner was like, you know, laughing maniacally about this. Like, see, I told you this is all crypto bullshit or whatever. So, you know, obviously that can, like, we all know that can't happen with Bitcoin, and that whole argument doesn't really need to be repeated. But I think interpreting the success that stablecoins have had is much more sensibly done, just because, you know, obviously that could happen with regular fiat as well, but the things you get with Tether are arguably better. The way I kind of resolve this tension in the article that I wrote about this, which I'm totally open to being accused of, like, naive Bitcoiner cope, I can see that as a, you know, completely valid criticism of this argument, but I think it's inevitable. I have no idea over what time frame, to be clear, but I think it is inevitable that stablecoins ultimately will settle over Bitcoin, probably over Lightning specifically. I don't think that detail matters that much, but at the very least, that the blueprint of Taproot assets and probably RGB as well, because I think Tether actually announced relatively recently they're probably going to issue an RGB before Taproot assets. But I think that, you know, the step in that direction just makes perfect economic sense. It will probably take a long time to happen just due to effectively liquidity constraints in Lightning, but it's a very natural evolution of trying to take as much about the way stablecoins work in broader crypto that is actually useful, but being more honest with your, I think I used language to this effect in the essay, I don't remember the exact wording, but just being more honest about to what extent do we really need a blockchain here? Like, what is a blockchain actually doing that's useful as opposed to just a database? I think that's like a classic Bitcoiner criticism of basically anything in crypto, right? That you just need a database for that. I think it completely applies to stablecoins. And with the caveat that if you want to, this is like a nice way of tying it all together, actually. If you want to have more than one stablecoin issuer, basically, if you want there to exist more than one bank in the world, which I think probably we do, to the extent you want these banks at all, but if you do, you want there to be more than one, you actually end up with a problem that is very similar to what Visa solves in fiat, like the point of Visa even existing, except it's much, much simpler to solve with Bitcoin and with Lightning, because you don't need this ridiculous complex of all these credit intermediaries. You just settle it via Lightning, but I was just saying via Bitcoin, right? You settle it via Bitcoin because Bitcoin is real money that you can debit through. So that's my thesis on stablecoins, I guess, that, you know, they're not worse Bitcoin, they're better fiat. In the very long run, they will probably converge on settling over Bitcoin anyway, because that design just makes more sense.
Yeah, it's almost like some kind of future version of the original abstraction of gold into paper.
Yeah. You can think of it that way, yeah.
Maybe let's pivot and talk a little bit about Axiom. I'm curious, you know, on a sort of high level, when you switched into the Bitcoin ecosystem from an investment management standpoint, like, what were some of those hard internal mindset shifts that came along with that when building a fund around Bitcoin?
That's a really interesting question. I don't want to pat myself in the back too much with this answer, but I honestly don't think there really were any, because just to be clear, my previous job was also in investment management, and I had been involved in admittedly much later stage, but still private investment rounds, both in general, but then kind of veering towards Bitcoin companies. And so the transition, I think, was very natural. I basically made it in the first place because, one, I sensed the timing was probably right. Like, I don't think you could have done effectively Axiom Fund 1 that much earlier. There were obviously people who did very similar things earlier than us, but they didn't do them that much earlier, right? They did them maybe 1 or 2 years earlier. So sensing that the time was right to, such that something like our first fund could even exist and could be viable, but also just recognizing that, you know, this subject matter, I guess, this industry, this, you know, burgeoning industry, is something in which I have such an outrageously enhanced competitive advantage as an investor relative to what my previous job was, right? And like, I really liked my previous job. I didn't rage quit or anything. I think very highly of my former employer. Hopefully they think relatively highly of me. You know, they manage like $300 billion and they're competing against everyone in the entire world on every subject, right? This was just so much more appealing. And the opportunity to have this kind of asymmetric advantage of knowledge and connections. And I mean, it's basically what I'm saying is kind of condensing the "we're so early" meme into specifically asset management, right? Like, this is how I channeled it. But yeah, I mean, just to round off, getting back to your question, I don't think really that much changed at all. It was just more exciting than what I was doing up until then.
And so then, to take it a step further, if you're thinking about like deploying in Bitcoin terms, like, How does that thought process have to change? And like, what are the considerations?
That's a really good question, because that is interestingly different. I think most of what I'm about to say is probably a bit of a cliche, because I think everyone who's worked in this space has probably landed on a very similar answer. Like, you kind of have to have this attitude, or otherwise you can't really justify what you're doing. That, for example, the saying Bitcoin is the hurdle rate, I think if anything is now a little bit cringe. Like, maybe a year or two ago it would have been more straightforward as rhetoric. I think treasury companies kind of ruined it, because for them it's like much more clear cut the extent to which Bitcoin is the hurdle rate. I would argue that in the case of venture investing, it's still true, but it's more interesting why it's true, which is basically that I think it's true in more than one way, as in it's true in like more than one area of decision making. It's true for our LPs in the sense that they can all just buy Bitcoin instead, right? Like, Bitcoin is very clearly their opportunity cost. And it's worth clarifying too that they're not by any stretch of the imagination orthogonal. Like, we are almost a subset of Bitcoin, right? So it's not like we're going to be uncorrelated. If we do well, that can only be because Bitcoin did well. If Bitcoin does poorly, there's no way that we can do well. So you have to believe in Bitcoin to believe in us. So you have to believe that we can outperform Bitcoin. I think I can't see any way around that logic. The way that we address that is by making the following argument, which, to your, you know, the point of your question, is very interestingly different to anything I would have ever had to justify in a completely generalist, you know, implicitly dollar denominated public equities environment. If we are to do well, again, just back to this point of like, what do you even have to believe in to want to invest in us? Probably Bitcoin's continued monetization. Probably. There might be some other rationale, but you know, I certainly believe in that. So I hope our LPs do as well. If you think that is going to happen, you probably also think that we need considerably more infrastructure than we have today. I think that almost follows definitionally, because if we didn't, then like, why hasn't it happened already? Like, what are we actually waiting for? If not this, you can give a more nuanced argument there, I guess, in terms of like where the infrastructure is needed and so on. But that actually leads perfectly into how we want to deploy, which is that I think it stands to reason that if that is true, then the companies that build this infrastructure will be the first to get on a Bitcoin standard, because basically what they're enabling for everyone else is getting on a Bitcoin standard. That's kind of the service that they're offering. And then the final piece is, again, if you believe that, the ones that do well should outperform Bitcoin simply by virtue of being profitable and having positive returns on a Bitcoin standard. That's what, there's kind of an amusing contrast here in that no one would ever say, I don't think anyone would ever say, outperform the dollar, right? You're profitable, right? If you make more dollars than you used, you're outperforming the dollar. And that's the kind of company we want to invest in, right? We want companies where, to be clear, we're not giving them Bitcoin, but in terms of their own unit economics, their hurdle rate for allocating capital is also Bitcoin. And so, you know, in the sense that they'll typically have Bitcoin treasuries as well. So they're much more prudently managed typically than the average, than like the Silicon Valley stereotype effectively, where you just throw money at everything and you see what sticks. And so at the level of the companies that we're investing in, if they do well, they will naturally outperform Bitcoin because they'll be earning in Bitcoin sooner than anybody else. And their success will be what drives Bitcoin's adoption and therefore success in the first place. So admittedly, that is a relatively involved chain of reasoning. My hope is that most of, maybe all of our LPs, certainly most, already believe most of that. And so kind of the only thing that really matters in terms of deciding to use us or not is, well, maybe two things. One is, you know, do I even want to take this risk, right? Can I just hold Bitcoin instead? And for what it's worth, we typically say, like, this doesn't always come up, but if it does, we will say, like, yes, have most of your Bitcoin allocation in Bitcoin, right? Don't give us, I don't know, 5% of that, maybe as a max, 10, but like beyond that, I'm not really comfortable anymore in what we're offering for you. But then probably more to the point, you know, are we good at what we're doing, right? Like, are we good investors? Or do we have any skill in identifying these companies? Because again, there's obviously a scenario in which Bitcoin does well and we do poorly. There's no scenario in which we do well and Bitcoin does poorly. So hopefully most of our LPs, hopefully most potential LPs in the future already believe most of this. It's up to us to convince them of the, you know, the final few bits and bobs that pieces it together.
As one final question for you, you know, you mentioned when you were talking there about how the companies that build this Bitcoin infrastructure ultimately become the first Bitcoin standard companies, which I completely agree with you. For other companies, the companies that will follow as a result of using those new technologies, you know, if you were advising like forward thinking leaders at sort of like non-Bitcoin outsider companies, and this is thinking about the world, you know, 3, 5, 10 years from now, like, what do you think companies should be thinking about as they are watching the Bitcoin world erected?
I would say something that I think is quite nuanced, because I'm very hesitant to say buy Bitcoin, right? Like, just as set back for a second, I'm very deliberate about literally never saying this to regular people. Like, I've said what I'm saying now, you know, significantly more times than it's ever even occurred to me to say go buy Bitcoin. I make a point of saying go learn about Bitcoin, and my prediction is you will then want to buy it yourself. But if you're only buying it because I'm telling you to, that's pointless. So that's what I would say to just regular people. And I think a very slightly modified version of that applies to companies as well, that obviously Bitcoin treasuries are all the rage now. I'm wary of saying you should also have a Bitcoin treasury, because if you're just doing it because, not that anyone would do it because I tell them to, but you know, if you're just doing it because of the hype, say, and you don't actually understand why you're doing it, then in all likelihood, you're going to end up selling at a loss, because you're just going to be confused and angry. And like, then you're actually put off taking it seriously for even longer. And again, we see this with regular people. So I don't think it's that big a leap to imagine a similar dynamic with the company. And so the advice would be the same too. It's slightly different in terms of how you implement it, but just learn about it, right? It is somewhat selfishly, from my perspective, given the companies in our portfolio, I would say things like, you know, think about, or maybe right back to the very first thing we talked about, right, with the fiat payment stack. If you're a business, you accept payments, like definitionally, if you're selling something. So do you actually understand how that works? Like, do you understand the costs? Do you understand the relative inefficiencies involved there? Can you articulate how this would be different if it happened on Bitcoin? That's by far the most straightforward one. Depending on what industry the company's in, there's maybe other avenues as well. Like if they're in any way connected to energy production or transmission, or maybe even consumption at industrial enough a scale, there's probably a mining angle. If they touch on capital markets at all, that's increasingly, you know, just Bitcoin is finding its way into more and more capital markets products and structures. And so there may even be cases where you actually arguably have a fiduciary responsibility to understand this. Not that you have to do it necessarily, but you know, this is one of the memes I'm happier about in the treasury company era, that it's got to a point now where in a couple more years time, people with fiduciary responsibilities are going to have to say why they didn't buy Bitcoin. Like, they're going to be pressed on this. And so not that they have to do it right now necessarily, but they do have to have a good answer as to why they're not doing it. So just things like that. You know, I'm not going to say just go buy Bitcoin, like go get a treasury just because that's what all the cool kids are doing now. But do think about how all of this works and how you're impacted. The fiduciary responsibility angle is maybe a bit like, it's kind of a veiled threat in a way that I'm not super comfortable with. But in the other areas, it's more like the education won't hurt you now, but the lack of it will in 10 years' time.
Very cool. Alan, I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing some of your insights. And for our listeners, if people want to find more of you online, is there anywhere you want to point people?
Most of what I do publicly is on Twitter. So I guess that's a good starting point. So just AlanF32 on Twitter. I guess if it's Axiom in particular you're interested in, we're on Twitter as well. It's at AxiomBTC. It's AXIOMBTC. And then our website is axiombtc.capital. So axiombtc.capital.
Right on. Well, thanks again. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in. Hope to see you next week. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.